Started late, we'll make a real effort to try and keep these as close to being on time as we possibly can. I apologize for being a little bit late. Appreciate where we had come yesterday. Again, we are without committee rules for the full Ways and Means, and this particular sub meets as a sub of a sub until such time as we've got at least one more person here. So with that, let's proceed. We were just getting into some of the information with regard to the director's office yesterday, and I think we had it. Cory, were you up at that time? Let's go ahead and continue on if we could, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cora Parker from the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management Division, for the record. And let me just confirm what you want me to start with this morning. We had talked yesterday about doing a DAS overview and then going into the director's office overview since we had got compressed with time yesterday. So unless I hear otherwise, that's what I will begin with this morning. You should have a paper copy of my slide presentation. I won't have anything on the wall for you, so we'll leave that to the DAS crew. The Department of Administrative Services budget is $651.3 million total funds for 0305. That's roughly a 1% increase from the fifth special session level for 0103. That total includes the Oregon Health Sciences University Opportunity Bond Program, which will actually be heard in the Education Subcommittee. I think Dallas mentioned that yesterday. It also includes the policy offices that will be heard for presentation purposes only in the governor's budget presentation to you. That's the Community Development Office, the Oregon Health Policy and Research Section, and the Rest and Return Programs. Position count is reduced from 968 positions at fifth special session to 927 positions in the governor's 0305 budget. Several of the divisions lost positions, but the bulk of the reductions were limited duration positions that were reduced in the Oregon Health Policy and Research Division. If you turn to the next slide, you see that the bulk of the agency's funds are in both the other funds limited and other funds non-limited categories. The revenue for both of those sources is derived largely from assessments and service charges, although the pies that you're seeing here also include those Oregon Health Science University funds, again, that would be pulled out when we get to work session and are talking about DAS-specific budget. The lottery funds piece that you see here is debt service payments on bonds that were issued this biennium for both Oregon Public Broadcasting and KSYS in Southern Oregon. And general fund is largely for those policy offices that we talked about, the Community Development Office, Oregon Health Policy and Research, and the Arrest and Reform Program. Again, the governor's budget is a 0.9% increase from the 0103 ledge approved through fifth special session level. The budget continues core programs for the most part, although some of those, especially the general fund programs, are at a reduced level. It continues funding for the Oregon Budget Information Tracking System. That is the system that's responsible for the detailed documents that you have in your budget binders. It also includes a package for statewide technology infrastructure needs, and we'll talk more fully about that when we look at the Information Resource Management Division's budget. And then, as Gary mentioned yesterday, it restores the Oregon Progress Board, but it does it within existing resources, so it does not ask for additional funds. The next chart just shows a pie breakout of all the different budgetary units within the department. And you'll see that there are a number of units there. Most of them are operational units. Some of them are only for budgetary purposes. For example, the miscellaneous distributions and the special government payments unit, those are not operational units in and of themselves. Those are basically the pass-through dollars that go to Oregon Health Science University, for example, that go to Oregon Public Broadcasting, Historical Society, also dollars that flow out to counties and cities and several other local government units, or non-governmental units for that matter. You see that the largest division is the Information Resource Management Division. That is a result largely of the transfer of the Publishing and Distribution Unit from what used to be the Transportation Publishing Print services, purchasing, I'll never get it right. TPPS, if I can pay for that one later.
I've contributed already.
Gary's contributed for me.
Okay.
We transferred 138 positions from that division to IRMD, and so IRMD now is the largest division operationally within DAS. Budget categories that you'll see on the next page, personal services is roughly 19%, services and supplies is 38%, and then again you see that the special payments category is a relatively large category. And that's most of the pass-through dollars that come through the departments. Also, capital outlay at 11% and debt services 9% for the division. And that's across all fund types.
Cora, one thing that the director said yesterday, and I'm still trying to figure it out, and that is how the print shop became information resource management. Why is printing an information resource?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Administrative Services. What we moved out were the printing functions that are all actually technology printing, where we print online, it's digital, and so on like that. It's not offset print. We left that alone. But we thought because all of this is really information technology based and everything, it made more sense to connect it to the information technology group rather than leave it with offset printers, that we could have all the technology people working together. That's why we made the transfer.
How many warm bodies are there?
There are only about four or five, Mr. Chairman, left on the offset printing side. And I don't know how many we transferred. Pauline, could you help me? What you think?
For the record, my name is Colleen Seelock. I'm the Director of Operations for the Department of Administrative Services. Technically, we did transfer all of the bodies to Information Resource Management Division. Gary is absolutely right. There's about 4 to 10 offset printer FTE.
4 to 10?
4 to 10. I'd have to go back and look.
Okay.
We'll get you that precise number. Both the Information Resource Management Division will be presenting information to you on that later in the in the DAS presentation, as will the now procurement fleet and surplus division.
Surplus services.
But Chair Beller, what we're going to do with the offset printing is, as we that particular section of folks will be phased out over a period of time. We're working with private industry on that. That's where the bulk of our privatization efforts have gone, and I believe the number, I'm going from memory here, is about 60% of our printing, the bulk of it in offset style printing, where it's the old actual ink under the fingernail kind of printing, is sent out the door and done by private firms for the state of Oregon, and those contracts are managed through that division.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if we can go on to the next slide, we talk about how the governor's budget was actually put together. The 103 legislatively adopted budget was at $500.5 million total funds. Legislatively approved actions through April 2002, and that's just a point-in-time budget date in our budget tracking system, had added $100.1 million total funds, and actually that included a $400,000 reduction in general funds at that time. Those changes were a result of emergency board actions, including approval of capital construction projects. I think the State Police Crime Lab was the largest, if not the only one in that category. Operating expense limitation increase in some of the divisions, for example, the electronic government, electronic commerce positions that were approved, as well as some grant funding increases related to the health policy and research section. Also, the Oregon Opportunity Bond Program, which was approximately $100 million, was approved at, I believe, the January e-board, and so that shows as an other fund special payment out in the DAS budget. Special session actions included across the board and specified reductions for several of the divisions. Again, most While most of the direct general fund reductions were in those small policy offices, the department actually took a number of operational actions internally that resulted in some indirect reductions to assessments for the agencies that pay those charges. And one that we were talking about actually before today's meeting was centralized trash pickup, which resulted in some reductions to uniform rent rates. So that's just an example of one of the administrative actions that the department took. Base budget adjustments on the next slide obviously include the roll-up of position actions and compensation changes during the 2001-03 biennium, and then debt service adjustments for existing outstanding bond and COP issuance during the current biennium. Essential packages for the department, a $9.6 million increase total funds. That's across all divisions. That includes phase-ins and phase-outs. It includes inflation, fund shifts, and vacancies, the other actions that are included there. And we'll talk about those in more a more detailed level when we get to the individual programs.
You just ask an over a high-level question regarding the debt service. I recognize a portion of it is for OPB. How much went to the radio stations down in Southern Oregon?
Chair Butler, I'll have to get you the precise numbers, but I believe total debt service this biennium is around $1.7 million.
Right.
And I believe it's approximately a 90-10 split on that, but at least the dollars out the door were. I'm not sure how the debt service split pulls out, but I can certainly get that information for you.
Yeah, I just would like to have had a better feel for the total debt that we incurred as a result of actions taken to fund public radio in Southern Oregon.
Certainly. Policy packages, again, at the department-wide level, there are 22 policy packages, and although that looks like a large number, that actually includes all of the sort of technical policy packages, which are special session reductions, analyst adjustments, which are program adjustments, e-board actions that occurred after that April 2002 point in time. So there are actually very few policy packages that were approved for the department's actually requested positions or other actions. $58.4 million total funds, the cost of those 22 packages. Again, that includes a $2.8 million reduction in general fund. And a large chunk of that increase is actually related to capital construction, and we'll talk more about that specifically when we get into the facilities division and look at the capital construction list there. Again, just for a quick overview, the department is funded largely by assessments and fees. Assessments fund portions of the director's office, the budget and management division, the controller's division, the information resource management division, facilities, and then procurement fleet and surplus services division. And then I've identified just a few of the fees because there are really a varied number of fees depending on the services that you're working with. But examples include that the risk division has insurance premiums. As we mentioned earlier, uniform rent payments go to the facilities division. The state controller's division has direct charges for some of the services that it provides. And then again, the information resource management division also has direct service charges for a number of its activities. That is it for the department-wide overview, and I will move into the director's office presentation if so pleases the chair. Okay. And you again should have a copy of this presentation in your book there. The director's office budget is a 4.7% total funds increase from the 2001-03 ledge approved through the special session level. Again, the director's office includes the Office of Economic Analysis, and where you see the bulk of general fund increase, it is for positions and activities that are related to that activity. Otherwise, the position change that you see here is really a reconciliation of when we moved positions. I think if you remember last time, we actually moved positions into the director's office, and then during that interim, we actually pulled them back out into the operations division, which we will discuss with you as a separate program unit. And in that reconciliation, it looks like we had a change, an increase in positions. In reality, we did not department-wide related to that activity. If you go to the next page, this just shows how the director's office is funded. Again, just 5.9% related to general fund. The bulk of the funding is related to assessments, and the other funds expenditures are 94.1% of total expenditures for the division. Again, you see that 4.7% increase, and the budget for this office continues core functions, and it does have a couple of policy packages, which I'll talk about in a moment. One of those is transferring highway cost allocation study to the Department of Transportation, and something that you'll see that I've identified as a technical adjustment that we'll need to work through, but that Gary mentioned yesterday, is the inclusion of the progress board. And when we built the governor's printed budget, we did not identify them in the director's office. Subsequent to that, a decision has been made that they will be established in the director's office, and so you'll see that as a technical adjustment that we need to make at a later date.
So the 5% reduction that the governor took in his salary, he didn't direct all his agency heads to take that as well, or double it, or match it, or anything of that nature. Representative Johnson's recognized.
Thank you.
No response here.
I don't know if we're going to come back and cover this in greater detail, but I recall from last regular session how controversial the departure of the cost allocation study was from ODOT to DAS. It was sent to DAS for the perception of, if not the reality, of a neutral forum to work out this very divisive political issue. Now it appears it's headed back. And my question is, did it get less controversial, or are we going to talk more about this later?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe that we will talk more about it when we get into the director's office presentation. But having worked in the Office of Economic Analysis in a past life, my understanding is actually that some of the controversy has been alleviated, in that the state economist has now worked with the highway cost allocation study, and the members that are working both on the study itself and that are on the big oversight group that are working to make sure that they agree with the methodology behind the study. And the state economist will remain involved, so his oversight role will still be in place. Now, that's not to say that there aren't still groups out there that have some level of concern I wouldn't be completely honest with you if I said everybody is 100% on board with this move. But at the same time, I don't think there's the level of controversy that there were a couple of years ago when we moved the study to the director's office. Does that help at all answer your question?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's not the level of controversy now. Great. The desired goal was achieved by moving it to DAS. I want to make sure that we don't reignite the controversy by moving it back. And I know that ODOT has gone out of their way to have a variety of citizen stakeholders. I'd certainly like the opportunity to at least hear from some of them before a rather arbitrary move is made that may rekindle a long simmering debate.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, you'll see a like package in the Department of Transportation's budget as well to move move some funds back into their department related to the study. So in addition to what you see in this committee, I believe the Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee will also be hearing the other side of that.
Cool.
So.
Great. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Yes, Senator Devlin's recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification on that. I don't think that it was spelled out, but one of the few things that survived from the 99 funding packages for transportation was the constitutional amendment actually putting the cost allocation into the Constitution. I don't believe that amendment spelled out which area of state government had responsibility, but I think that's been a significant change, too, because before it was simply a statutory requirement, and I think some of the interests believe now that politely. whatever the study comes up with is something that the legislature can't ignore. So that may be a polite way to put it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I think you are correct about some of the language being moved into the Constitution, and there has been some change in just the aura of how the study is done, who's involved, where there is oversight versus where there may not have been before. But if you need additional information, I'm certainly happy to bring something back to you.
I'm just aghast that the legislature would ever ignore any kind of a study. even the perception that would happen, Senator, is beyond me.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I got the perception that, not in our history, but history long ago, he used to settle this over a table somewhere down in Cafe Today.
Please proceed.
Okay. Moving on to the next slide, or we may have went over this. I apologize if this is a repeat. The director's office budget is approximately $4 million total funds, and that breaks out into a relatively small percentage going to services and supplies, and the bulk of the dollars really are for personal services in this division. Again, the director's office began the 2001-03 biennium with about $3.4 million total funds. Legislatively approved actions through April 2002 reduced $129,176 other funds, and that was in the second special session that reduction was taken. Again, base budget adjustments include position actions and compensation changes during the biennium, and essential packages, which, again, Gary will talk about in a little bit more detail during his presentation, include about $200,000 total funds for the department. Again, two policy packages within this division. Package 310 is what we've talked about already, to some extent at least, and that's transferring the highway cost allocation study back to the Department of Transportation. That eliminates $227,473 other funds expenditure limitation in the Office of Economic Analysis. It eliminates half of a full-time equivalent authority position. And the Department of Transportation budget, as I mentioned, has an offsetting, although I don't think the dollars are exact, it has an offsetting package as well. And again, this removes some of the direct costs related to the study, but the state economist will still be involved in the oversight of that study. And there's not a complete elimination of activity involved. Package 311 is strengthening Oregon's economic forecasting, and this includes approximately $31,000 other funds expenditure limitation to reclassify two positions in the Office of Economic Analysis. I believe those positions are the state revenue forecast position, Mike Kennedy's position, who you may be familiar with, and the position related to state criminal population forecast. And that really is to bring those positions in line with other positions in the division as well as statewide. And again, just a quick overview of funding for the director's office. Assessment provide most of the dollars that go into this division. The charge to state agencies has increased from $3.6 million in the 2001-03 biennium to $4.4 million in the 2003-05 governor's budget. And technical adjustments that we'll need to deal with during work session. Again, salary freeze and other position-related actions that you've already expressed interest in pulling out during work session. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the restoration of the Oregon Progress Board and just how to formally lay that into the director's office budget. And that is it for my overview, unless there are questions.
Are there questions relative to the director's office? Representative Johnson is recognized.
Mine from yesterday, and you may have said this. I apologize for being late. The executive director of the Progress Board salary.
And I think Gary has that in his presentation.
Great. Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I'm Gary Weeks, director of the Department of Administrative Services. And let me, if I might just start follow up on some of the questions you left for us. One was the question on the director's salary for the Progress Board.
The salary is $7,703 a month, which is $92,436 a year. That's the top step of the salary range that the director is in at this point. You also asked questions about the insurance for physicians, for dentists, I should say, specifically in 1999. That program was created. It was created at the request of the Northwest Medical Teams, and it was intended to serve retired physicians, dentists that were working with the medical teams. The original appropriation was $25,000 for the 1999-01 biennium. $6,234 was expended for insurance for these folks. In the next biennium, the 01-03 current biennium, we appropriated $10,000. I should say you appropriated $10,000. Thus far, we've spent $3,871. What is unexpended always reverts to the general fund. So in the first biennium, we reverted $18,700 to the general fund, and barring any other expenditures for this biennium, we'll revert about $6,000 for the current biennium.
You addressed the tail coverage issue in that point.
You know what, Mr. Chairman, I assume that the tail coverage is there, but I'll have to check. I mean, having been the insurance commissioner, all policies have a tail on. I don't know the length of this, but I'll find that out. I apologize. I didn't check that specifically. We had one, outside of Northwest Medical Teams, there was one dentist in Eugene who contacted us about this program in the first biennium. And we, of course, worked with that individual. Beyond that, we have, aside from the Northwest Medical Team people, we haven't had a conversation with anyone. They are, the Northwest Medical Team folks are aware that this is not in the budget. We've had specific conversations with them so that they understand that. I don't know exactly. My understanding is there's not a lot of heartburn over that, but you know, it does mean that they have to, if they're going to insure folks, they may have to find $2,000 or $3,000 to do this. So that's the status to date.
Okay, thank you.
And then the third thing that we're working on, Mr. Chairman, for all of you, is a very short little paper that will further describe the revenue expenditure report that I was telling you all about, the online real-time system. And we also want to add to that Orbitz, the Oregon budget system, which is a higher level. I want to give you a couple of paragraphs discussion about that so you understand how what we've developed within DAS fits into the larger system that applies to all state agencies. Because I don't want an impression that there's redundancy and stuff. Okay. So we'll have that for you by Monday. By Monday, Mr. Chairman. It'll be very short and try to keep it succinct.
See, that's right. We do not meet tomorrow, do we, as a subcommittee? Perhaps we'll meet in a full committee with rules.
Perhaps.
Wouldn't that be wonderful? Okay. Please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that catches all the questions you had, and we'll try to stay on top of that. Some of this you will find redundant to Cora's presentation, but we'll do it anyway. Package 310. She's already mentioned to you transfers this responsibility for the highway cost allocation study back to ODOT. I think Cora was correct in saying this is probably not without some difference of opinion. I mean, I've already heard that the truckers have some reservations about putting this back in ODOT. We felt it was, you know, after the controls that were put in the last biennium and the involvement of the state economist and the continuing involvement of the state economist even after it's transferred, that it actually makes sense to put it back in ODOT. It's an ODOT function, not a DAS function. If the legislature feels for purposes of its independence and credibility it ought to stay in DAS, well, obviously we'll manage it through DAS. But there probably will be some objection to this transfer. We have eliminated one position. That was a position that was a limited duration position, and its purpose was to conduct this study of DAS services. So going out to all the clients that DAS serves to find out what's the level of service and how are we doing and so on like that, we did not continue that position. And there are three positions then that are part of the budget for the Progress Board. And as Cora and I have both said, they're positions are in the budget. There's no resource in the budget. It has to be funded somewhere within DAS, and we'll be working on how we do that. Performance measures, we've talked yesterday, I think, about much of this, the progress board and its job to maintain the work of Oregon Shines and Oregon Strategic Vision. But more important to that is what I tried to express yesterday, and that's the governor's real interest in trying to use the progress board in a way that drives performance throughout state government. We haven't used the progress board in that sense before. But other duties of the progress board are around the benchmarks and trying to get agencies to achieve the targets, continuing to build an awareness of what Oregon benchmarks are and what Oregon Shines really means, and providing quality service throughout our system. The Office of Economic Analysis, reliable and certain forecasting information for the state of Oregon. Certain meaning, not certain that it's accurate, but certain kinds of information. And this is an arena where I think you're going to find a lot of conversation this session. There are many folks in this building who are interested in looking at the forecasting methodology, thinking more about whether it is the right methodology to be using in today's world. And I know some members of the legislature that are looking at models in other states. People have contacted me, so it'll be a rich discussion about how we do the forecasting in this state in the future.
There's certain guarantees in the Office of Economic Analysis.
There's no, Mr. Chairman, there's no certainty in the forecast.
Did someone and some other state come up with a certain forecast?
I don't think there's a certain forecast anywhere, certain in terms of its accuracy and so on. But there are a number of different models. Some near us, the state of Washington has a different model than we do, and
it proven to be more accurate than our model.
It's fairly new, so I don't know if it's more accurate or not. But it brings together, as I understand it, the forecasting efforts that happen in the legislative assembly there and in the executive branch, and so they're really brought together in more of a joint forecasting model. And there's more sharing of responsibility in their methodology between the two branches, executive and legislative branches, sharing responsibility for the forecast itself.
I guess I've always sensed that our forecast wasn't done in the vacuum with regard to the bringing together of the Department of Administrative Services with legislative revenue and the other folks, and it was pretty much dynamic in that regard. So the old joke is, you know, to try and get two economists to agree on anything, any one thing at any one time. You know,
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to suggest that you know, Paul Warner hasn't worked with Tom Petoskey. They do. It's just there's a more formal relationship that occurs in some states like Washington. And I'm going to bring that up because I've had two members come to me and show me the Washington plan and say, well, you know, what do you think about this? Should we be looking at that, at this model? Is it an improvement? And my comment is I think there are a number of members who are interested in talking about the forecasting model.
You know, I'd sure hate to do anything that would lessen the dynamics of how those folks do work together now.
Absolutely.
or to make it so formal that they had to schedule public meetings to sit down and talk to one another about the concerns that they might have at the instant moment. So that's
agreed.
I guess that's a concern that I would have. And if there was some sure science out there that gave us the sure fix every time, give me the inside lead on it, because I've got some market questions that I need to resolve anyway. So anyway, thank you.
All right, Mr. Chairman. Essential packages, we've has gone through some of these, but we have one package that is adjusts for our mass transit inflation. It has an impact of $41 on the general fund, and there's some adjustments made for savings that we have from vacancies, and that has a small impact on the other funds. We have a package, O2O, that adjust the budget for program changes and restorations of one-time reductions. What this is about is during the special sessions when there were some reductions made to the budget, there were things taken out, and one in particular is around attorney general fees. As I understand it, at the time, the agency wasn't spending its up to its limitation for attorney general fees. That was reduced as a part of the reductions that we took. This package actually restores some of those things, restores some of the AG fees back to a level that we think we may need for the current biennium. The next package, 030, is the inflation and price changes, modest impact on the general fund of about $4,600 and $60,000 in other funds. The purpose is to recognize some inflationary changes that have occurred in the cost of goods and services and expenditures in that arena. So they're pretty limited packages in that instance. Here's the package that we've come back to more than once, 310, transferring the responsibility for the highway cost allocation study back to ODOT from DAS. Cora mentioned the next package, 311, which is a reclass of two of the analysts in the Office of Economic Analysis. We've done, I think, good work trying to make sure that these are the right market change. We did desk audits of both of these positions. And you know, I'm hesitant to bring packages for reclasses in front of you for all the reasons we talked about yesterday. But these are two we think we have to have in order to hang on to people that we need in the Office of Economic Analysis. Package 232 is for the Progress Board. It's the three positions in the Progress Board. There's no funding for them. And at some point, we will have to, during work session, come to you, Mr. Chairman, and say, here's how we figured out to fund these positions. But right now, all that exists is the position authority.
Director, just relative to the broad brush view of that, I wonder if, particularly in the director's office, I'm concerned about the history of the increase in cost of the AG's fees, and I have a concern about the director's office using AG fees as well. I wonder if we might have just a five biennium examination of how much AG's fees have increased and what the utilization is in the director's office for, you know, again, I don't know that we need any specifics, but Colleen can probably lay her hands on that in a hurry. And I'm just anxious to, our AG fees have doubled everywhere in the state in the last five biennium easily. And it's just a concern, and we try and hire the very best people, and then we end up having lawyers run the show. So just want to try and see if we can't circumvent that.
Mr. Chairman, we'll put that together. That's something easy to do. We'll show you five biennium worth of costs, and then in some instances there may be one or two particular lawsuits that have really driven these costs, and we'll identify that for you in each biennium.
Maybe time to fire our lawyers and get new ones if we're not winning the lawsuits every time. We've got to scare them away. We've got to get this big junkyard dog AG operation going here so that we only have to spend 2 hours a year in every department. People just say, well, I'd never sue them. I don't know. Anyway, excuse me for going on that, but we just spend a lot of money on it.
Yeah, that is true, Mr. Chairman. Having been the beneficiary of more lawsuits in this state probably than anyone around still, I can vouch for that. Budget notes. We had one budget note, and that was that the director was expected to report the improvements that have been made in state government as part of the budget presentation. Each of the divisions is going to identify those for you independently, so we will have that report by division. And then the last piece of what we were asked to bring to you is, I think we have talked about this some, the vacancies. We have 20 FTE in the director's office. There are four positions vacant. One is support position that's in recruitment. Two are the two that I mentioned yesterday in internal audits. And I feel very strongly about these two positions, and I'm hopeful I can be persuasive that we ought to keep these positions. I would fill them, one with an information technology auditor and another with just a straight CPA. And then the final position is one that's abolished. That was the half-time limited duration position we used to do some research for us. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes our presentation on the director's office.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Weeks, for the positions, we went through this yesterday, that that are vacant that we will identify as we go through each section. There's probably a range in this regard, but in the budget itself, those items are included as policy packages, but at what step are they included in most cases?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, on the reclass packages for like the two people in the economic analysis, when someone's reclassed, they go to the next step in the new class. So that generally means anywhere between a 4.5% and a 5% increase in pay when they move to the next step. If you're asking me about all the positions that are vacant, what's the average step?
What is the intent in terms of to fill them at?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, I'm sorry. If the two positions that are in the audit internal audit area that are vacant that I would like to fill would be filled at first or second step. That's generally where you fill new positions. My intent is not to start positions at top step. I don't do that.
That's an excellent question, Senator. Do you want to follow up on that? This may be a good.
No, in a prior life, I just saw positions brought in at top steps, and 2 years later saw reclassification proposals for those same positions. So
that's really an excellent observation. I appreciate that. I don't anticipate that will happen under this director.
Mr. Chairman, I think Cora wants to have some piece of clarification.
I just wanted to make a clarification, too, regarding vacant positions. I think this may address some of where your question is going, Senator Devlin. If positions were vacant when we started the budget process, which I believe these two positions, the audit positions that you mentioned, were vacant, those typically are rolled over at the second step for budgeting purposes. So as Gary mentioned, that means that for budgetary purposes, they would have funds basically to hire them at first or second step, and any decisions to do otherwise would have to come elsewhere from a funding source, would have to come out of the budget in a different area. So, and that's not true just of the director's office. That's true of the budget process statewide. If positions are vacant when we start that budget, there are really very few exceptions where they are budgeted at higher than a second step.
They may be hired at the first step, but during that budget process,
Correct.
The budget biennium,
you're
accounted for at the second step.
Absolutely.
Okay, all right.
Thank you, Cora. That's helpful. And, I mean, we try to take, Mr. Chairman, Senator Devlin, we also try to pay attention to if someone's transferring in from one agency to another into a new position, I generally would not cause them to take a demotion. You know, I would bring them across if their salary within the range and stuff. So,
please proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, next on our agenda is the State Controller's Division, and I just wanted to introduce to you John Radford. John is a 30-year employee in financial management, and I consider myself very lucky that he hasn't retired yet, and we'll try to keep him around throughout my tenure here. But John has had great experience in this agency, and I think we benefit a lot from what he brings to the job. So, John, do you want to start your presentation? Mr. Chairman, we have to load up.
Okay, that's fine.
So take just about a minute or so.
So while you're doing that, I do want to express my appreciation for the fact that you have indicated that your auditors will be hired, which would include a straight CPA as opposed to a crooked CPA.
Ramrod straight, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. I was afraid that I was afraid he wasn't going to be a straight CPA. So he or she, I guess I should say, to be politically correct. Good morning, John.
Good morning, sir. Good morning, members of the committee. It's Chair Butler. My name is John Radford. For the record, I'm with the state. That's mine, sir. I'll put yours over here.
Now, you know what the piggy bank for American Cancer Society, and
that's right.
And you're going to be using some acronyms.
I'll participate. I think I even got some acronyms up there in the slideshow for you. So.
Thank you.
Let's see. I'm going to change my presentation a little bit from the order that we've been asked to present, and for the specific reason to try to give you a background without you knowing what we do is probably just a little bit problematic. So what I'd kind of like to do is give you kind of a first couple of slides here, a description of what it is that we do, so that you have some context when you take a look at mission, organization, goals, that kind of thing. Would that be all right for me to do that? I think that's probably better from your perspective. Our division is, you know, as you know, accountants are a fairly conservative bunch. And as Gary mentioned, I've been around probably longer than I care to admit. And go back to the 60s, 70s, and 80s when you look at the development of budget approaches. Going back to the 60s with the McNamara approach on program performance budgeting, and then we have budget by objectives or management by objectives budgeting and zero-based budgeting. And for all of my career, I pretty much have followed a Hawaiian budget approach. In honor of Mr. Wayan here, we use that Hawaiian approach called Lakamula.
Lakamula.
So we've always taken kind of a conservative approach to budgeting. As from an overview standpoint, let me tell you, you know, the accounting systems and the payroll systems are kind of central. The central kind of the workhorse of keeping track of financial activities in the state. And off that we have various major and subsystems that are linked to either incoming or outgoing or both. For example, the budget system, the payroll system, the HR system, purchasing systems, and then not to mention a bunch of system subsystems that are occurring out in the agencies, all processing financial transactions, and we've got the core kind of accounting system for the state in addition to the payroll system. So that's important kind of contextually to understand how these systems fit together. And, of course, with the modern technology and telecommunications and databases that we have, these systems are aligned such that they can communicate with each other, sharing information, sometimes sequentially and sometimes online. And so that's generally, systems is a big part of our operation. And of course, the systems are developed and designed and put in place, implemented with national standards in mind and compliance with those national standards, and of course best practices in the telecommunications and computer industry. Control, of course, is a big part of our organization. We develop most of the policies and procedures at a high level anyways that control the financial transactions and the information going into our systems. We produce as a work product an annual financial statement. And that's an aggregation of financial information from around the state. And then another activity that we're involved in for cost efficiency reasons, we're providing accounting and budgeting services to about 26 small agencies, and I'll touch on that as we get to the spiel here. Our customer base and stakeholders is wide and varied. Employees, of course, we deliver paychecks and other kinds of financial information. We deal directly with agency fiscal officers around the state, accountants and payroll professionals, sometimes budget analysts, sometimes purchasing people. The data that we have in our systems serve the legislature and the governor in terms of financial planning purposes and control purposes. So we have a single database that the legislature draws on. We have a single database that feeds the budget system that the governor and his staff use. So that's the kind of gets you the kind of the flavor of the kind of the central core function of the accounting system. Our CAFR, our annual financial report, comprehensive annual financial report, is distributed out to a variety of locations. The primary users of this document, not to mention the federal government and academics, but the primary purpose and use of that document is the bond rating agencies who look at the results of our financial operations for the fiscal period and our financial position and make various judgments about our financial health and the prospects for our financial health. Vendors, we make disbursements out of our accounting system, of course, to various vendors that process transactions through our system, and, of course, our small agencies. So our organization is divided into six functional teams, and those are listed here for you, and I'm going to kind of go through briefly each one of those so you kind of get an idea about the depth and breadth of our organization. Division administration, that's generally about four FTE. We have a division administrative assistant there and two clerical support. One does clerical kinds of functions and telephone receptionist duties and that kind of thing. And one of the positions that we have, and I'm going to talk about later, is a statewide internal control manager. Now, when Mr. Greenfield was here last, he set a new course of direction for DAS, which would be more of a management function in the state of Oregon. And when we took a look at that direction and thought about what we could do internally, we carved out a resource for an internal control manager. Shortly after the session ended and the new biennium began, we began a recruitment process for that position, and by November or December, I was just about ready to make a selection to fill that job, and we got hit with the revenue problems. And so we just voluntarily decided that we're going to put this on hold pending the outcome, and of course it got worse and worse, and so we've kept it vacant, and our goal is to get that position filled by the beginning of the new biennium. Now, so that's why that position has been vacant most of the time here. We have not filled that position. But I was glad to hear Mr. Weeks talk about his strength of his support for internal auditing, and this position is kind of like that from a central perspective, and I'll talk about that a little bit and show you why that is. And it has to do with DAS's ability to be out into the field and within those agencies to look at the control structures that those agencies have in place to mitigate fraud, waste, and abuse, and our desire to have some compliance resource out there rather than just sitting in the ivory tower dictating policies and procedures, if that makes sense. So that's the administration division, or section of our division. The next one is our statewide financial management services division. This is the core group of approximately 22 FTE that handles the day-to-day and the systems development of our core financial system. This is a system that was implemented in the mid-90s. We have maybe 2,000 at any time FTEs accessing the database, accessing the application, and processing fiscal transactions. They do the day-to-day operations. They're involved in reconciliation, troubleshooting problems, giving us direct assistance to the accountants and fiscal staff and the agencies. We also provide some training and other kinds of support services. The next section is our statewide accounting and reporting unit. This is the top accountants. This is a group of the top accountants in the state. They're the ones that interpret generally accepted accounting principles. We have a couple of national standard-setting groups that design financial accounting and reporting standards. This is the group that interprets those standards and translates those into policies and procedures for the agencies and embed those kinds of controls within the system, help our systems people embed those controls within the system. They are also the group that develops and prepares the annual financial report for the state. The next group is our...
The size of the accounting and reporting group?
About 9 FTE.
Thank you.
They also provide security for the system. We don't want people who are in systems providing security. It's an internal control, separation of duties kind of apparatus to ensure that we have secured... that individuals out in the agencies accessing our system and our processing transactions do not have ability to cause us some problems.
Okay.
The Oregon State Payroll System is 6 FTE, and of course they're responsible for the business side, the functional side analysis of the system, and providing ongoing help desk support to the agencies. They do reconciliations, they process transactions. 6 FTE, we pay about roughly 40 to 45,000 payments a month, issue about 45,000 W-4s a year. And so they are quite a busy group. I like to say this group is probably the lowest cost payroll group in the nation. There's one probably lower, that's West Virginia. And on a per unit basis, I like to say if you let me pay twice a month, I can get my unit cost down too. So that's the Oregon payroll system. Shared client services, and I'm going to... There's another slide in here that we talk about intergovernmental services, and this is... Maybe I'll just cover it once and I don't have to repeat myself. This is basically our group that handles the accounting and financial reporting and budgeting services for about 26 small agencies. These are a group of 6 FTE. They process their transactions, they set up their accounting structures, they provide reports to those small agencies, and of course, it's the economy of scale here that we get without having to hire an accountant for each of those 26 agencies in the governor's office. We achieve tremendous savings that way by consolidating these efforts within this small group of staff. The next slide shows about three FTE.
Before you go on, may I ask you about that small services? I know a number of the small agencies that you do. Do you do any of the commissions?
Small boards and commissions, a few. I don't recall right offhand exactly the names of them, but we do small boards and commissions, about 26. If you're talking about the agriculture commissions, we do not do any of those.
Specifically, what I was talking about was any of the general fund commissions, Asian, Hispanic, women.
Chair Butler and Representative Johnson, yes, we do those. We do a couple of those, if not all of them. And I'm going to address some of the problems that we had with those agencies.
Good. I'll wait till you come there, because I'm looking for efficiencies within those commissions to see if they could possibly share common space, a common back room, because much of their functions are the same: donor acknowledgments, payroll, standard accounting. And it seems to me that having those administrative costs replicated across the commissions doesn't make any sense at all. But if there are problems, I'll wait until we get to that.
I can address that. We've had some audit problems with those agencies, and we've had some a different approach in terms of providing some training and some development for those staff. But what you're talking about is maybe having some kind of an umbrella organization that would start to manage those agencies, and we don't really do that. They're really pretty much managed on their own.
Well, thank you.
This Statewide Revenue Services is a relatively new division section that we've had over the past couple of years. There are two primary functions here. One is coordination of an accounts receivable management effort in the state. And back in the early 90s, we tried to get a staff person. It was tough budget times, and we were not able to secure an FTE for this. Then in the mid-90s, the audits division did a study, an audit of accounts receivable. How well does the state do that? And that audit was released. Some collection agencies picked up on it, and we agreed. We said, you know, we would like to have at least one FTE provide some direction, some management, some focus for statewide accounts receivable. And that's primarily the section that's doing that right now, is to providing that leadership for accounts receivable.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have watched that report with interest. I ran a small business, and I know receivables are the bete noire of any business. It seems to me that we still don't have a really good handle on receivables. And I'm looking for you to disabuse me of any false impressions that I have. It seems that they grow, it seems that they languish, that we don't get on them in a timely way. Could you offer any insight that might correct misimpressions that I have about how adroit we are in policing those up?
Representative Butler and Representative Johnson, we could probably spend a couple hours on this topic alone. We have on our financial statements somewhere around 5.9 or 5.8 billion in receivables. And that's at a very high aggregate level. If you think of ourselves as a pyramid, we're right at the top of that information. As you peel back the onion, you start going layer by layer by layer, it gets very complex and it gets very dispersed, the numbers and types of receivables that we have. For example, just the first cut, you can take a look at that 5.9. About half are long-term contracts and mortgages, notes, that kind of thing. The other half of that is more current receivables, collectible receivables. When you get into that and start dividing it up, $2.5 billion, almost a billion of that is scholarship loans and Perkins loans and that kind of thing. And then you get to large receivable balances in employment. You get judicial receivables, which somewhat are problematic in terms of collection. When you start taking a look, then you get the differences between general fund receivables and other funds receivables, that kind of thing. For the most part, those agencies are doing an outstanding job in terms of collecting. We've got all the collection rates for those agencies. Just to give you an example on the collection contracts, we've got about 11 collection contracts that we're using right now. In 2000, of the accounts that were passed in the year 2000, collection total private collection firms, 1.7 million, that was a collection rate of 1.83%. Okay, and we collected out of that 1.83%, we collected 1.7 million. In 2001, we're getting better, 2.7 million was collected. 2.7 million collected, that represented a collection rate of 1.42%. In 2002, $5 million were collected by collection firms at a collection rate of 1.86%. So, in the collection rates that we're seeing in the agencies vary depending upon the type. If they're really highly collectible, we're getting a much higher rate of collection. For example, DOR collection rate on taxes is well in excess of about 95% or so, or excuse me, around 95%. And you get into the more problematic accounts, we're anywhere from 95% down to almost zero. So it's all over the board in terms of collectability. But that's we could do a couple hour presentation on this.
That was very helpful. And it appears that if we were able to collect $5 million, that turning some of these over to outside collections has proved efficacious.
Yes. We are very pleased with the collection agencies that are out there working on our behalf. I think from their perspective, though, I mean, let's be honest, they would like higher collectability in terms of the accounts that are passed to them. The agencies have governmental tools and other tools to help them collect, and so they're doing their job. And so we've got that kind of tension.
With your
go ahead, indulgence. Want to follow up?
The higher collectability, the issue of timeliness seems to loom large in that discussion. And perhaps there would be an opportunity for you at DAS, I mean at Department of Administrative Services, to give guidance to agencies in terms of turning those over more expeditiously. I also have to tell you that just as a personal aside, the student loans bother me the worst. For somebody to have had the opportunity to get assistance to go to school and then flake on the repayment of those notes, I think is just outrageous.
This is something that Senator Winters has worked on carefully, and the chair recognizes Senator Winters.
Thank you. As the author of the legislation led yes. into this, the issue of timeliness that Representative Johnson raised is one that's of extreme importance to me, because I understand we have not done that good of a job in talking to the industry of getting the accounts done in a timely fashion. We still have the problem of perhaps having accounts sitting on the books a lot longer than what we should. And I know there's a move this foot of perhaps speeding it up a bit if we have to do it through legislation. My preference is that Department of Administrative Services with the agencies will say, you know, if we go past a certain amount of time, we will automatically turn those over. You know, it was recognized when we first started this that some agencies do not have the capacity of collecting, and nor should we make them collectors. And that was one piece of what we're the driver. The other one that even with Department of Revenue recognizing that they do have the skills, sometimes even they, because of all the other activities, do not get those done. And so I'm just saying that because I am looking at the timeliness issue. You know, I know that the longer debt sits there and isn't getting collected, the least likely is it is going to get collected. So I would impress that you really look at this timeliness issue and impress on the agencies rather than sitting on it, and even the Department of Revenue, that they turn those over. I think we'd rather collect 50% or 25% on the dollar than to collect nothing on the dollar.
Chair Butler and Senator Winters, that's exactly right. There is a relationship between the time of when that account is created and the collectability as time goes on, and there's also a dichotomy of cost related to that. It's easier to collect quicker with a lower cost, and the longer that account sits there, the greater the cost. And agencies are cognizant of that as they apply their scarce resources to this effort. But I tell you what I think we can do is we've got some pretty sharp people. I'm just blessed with a great crew, and I think we could probably hold together some information from the agencies for you and kind of give you an analysis of the timeliness issue there. That is some information that might help you.
follow. There is the new report that's out on debt collection does demonstrate that we've got a timeliness problem. So I'm just putting that back out there, that I'd like to see that timeliness issue go away. We know we now have entered into relationships with the collection agencies. There's two issues here. We don't want the debt to stay on the books so long that even if we send them over to them, that the probability of them collecting is nil. You know, I think when we first turned over accounts to them, some of them had been on the books for such a long period of time, even to do skip tracing. To find them is a task that, you know, they've also exhausted all their resources, and probably wouldn't want to continue to do business with us if we continue to do that kind of referral, because it's not cost effective for them as well.
That's true.
So I would just ask that you really do look at this timeliness issue and see if we cannot shorten the length of time.
Chair Butler, Senator Winters, we will develop an analysis based on the report that we just put out, and we'll come back to you with some information on that. I would note that I think what we're seeing in the numbers here, as we look at 2000 at 1.7, 2001 at 2.7, 2002 at 5, I think what you're seeing is a natural progression of those accounts that are just outright not collectible, period, are weeding out of the system, and agencies are, I think, and I may be wrong, but I think they're turning over quality accounts faster now. And that's why we're seeing the numbers rise. But we'll get an analysis of that to you and make sure we understand what that is.
There appears to be a doubling within the last two or three years. Some of that certainly could have been generated as a result of encouraging the departments to move this information over. One area of concern that I have is whether or not this includes all of the postings from the circuit courts. I know that at one time we had circuit court folks last session come forward and we asked them about, you know, how they were coming with their collecting. Well, they're doing a great job collecting on those that they have posted in the system. The concern that we had was that when we asked them how much they had posted in the system, one court system up in Multnomah had $80 million that was unposted. In other words, they just hadn't gotten around to putting that in the books. Now, you know what that would do to a small private business if they just didn't get around to posting their accounts receivable, let alone the collection of them. And then you have a pretty good idea when the kind of people that you're dealing with, you know, by the time you get them posted 60 or 90 days later, you know, those folks, you've just taken an $80 million account receivable and put it in a non-sanfordized sewing or washing machine because it's gone. So that's a concern that I have, is the timeliness before we even get, I mean, this can't start to age until it gets posted into the system. And if it's already aged 90 days, those are the best days that we should have been collecting. And that's a concern that I have, Senator Winters, that if your report tells us only based upon those that are in the system, that's one piece of information. It's the concern that I've got is how fast between the time that the assessment is made and then the collection information, the data is accumulated, begins to accumulate in age. That would be important.
Representative Butler, I hate to speak on behalf of a separate branch of government, but I believe they are very cooperative with us. They've been showing a lot of interest in this, and I'm sure they're doing the best they can, and I'll get some information from them.
It would be very important to do that, John, if you would, please.
We'll do that. They're very cooperative. They're right on point with us, and they're catching up rapidly. And
great.
I think I don't know that they've solved that issue that you mentioned at the detail level, but we are confident that we've got all of that information that we do.
Good. Thank you.
Mr.
Senator?
Chair, would you also, just to follow up on Representative Johnson, the educational community was very reticent, if you will, not wanting to be a part of this process and not really wanting to be actively engaged in collecting from students. Could you, just for that piece alone, I would like to know if they're a lot more amenable to collecting than when we first started.
Chair Butler, Senator Winters, we'll find out what the current situation is on that. There might be some federal issues involved in terms of some federal requirements, but we'll find out what's going on.
I think our instructions to them were, you know, I understand the federal piece of it, but, you know, that's the same too with some of the child support issues and some of those with the Department of Justice. But where we have the state interest, that doesn't preclude us from going after what legitimately are dollars that are owing to the state.
Please. A couple of assignments there on that one.
Okay.
Accounts receivable.
The other part of this accounts the shared services section has to do with e-commerce, and that is, as you know, a developing application that's being developed in the DAS IRMD division, and we are providing technical and kind of leadership on the end of the financial aspects of that, particularly on e-commerce as we process. And, of course, as we scale up with more and more transactions, we're more and more concerned and are providing additional support and resource for that effort from the e-commerce standpoint. That's the kind of the crux of our organization, systems, accounting, payroll, support, that kind of thing. Here's our mission statement for our division. Support and ensure accuracy and accountability in state government financial systems, providing services and controls in a variety of functions. We could probably add e-commerce to that now. The three kind of important terms there are accuracy, accountability, and controls, and that's really the crux of our mission here, is to provide systems that protect the accuracy and integrity and make sure that our financial information is in compliance with national standards. We pass audit muster here, if you will, for all of our activities. The goals here are, of course, to provide leadership. We're at the corporate level of the organization, so naturally one would expect that we would provide leadership for statewide financial management initiatives. And that runs the gamut of accounting and accounts receivable, as we've kind of discussed, e-commerce issues. We also provide, of course, financial policy and procedure guidance to states. This is in the area of processes and business processes, and pretty much on controls, making sure that there's adequate segregation of duties and other kinds of controls within our systems. We built in edits and controls, of course, and we want to make sure that those are complete and are to the maximum extent possible protecting resources. Moving on, another slide for goals. We produce statewide financial reports, and those, of course, are important for us to meet standards. It's a part of that governance and accountability function that a corporate office has. Professional training, advice, and customer support. We have several help kinds of desks set up for helping agencies process financial transactions, payroll transactions. We provide customer support to them. We do professional training as to the greatest extent we can. We partner with a lot of outside professional organizations to bring in training for state agencies. We are concerned about that workforce out there, particularly given kind of an elevated sense of turnover in that workforce. Full compliance with national standards and regulations, and of course we strive for a clean audit opinion on our financial statements, and easy access to reliable financial data. And, of course, one of our things that we've done here is to create a data mart, an online data mart, so that the data that's removed from the mainframe comes down to a data mart. That data mart is online. It can be accessed over the Internet, and agencies are making very, very effective use of that data mart. So it's easy, online, reliable access to data that is really key here for us in terms of a strategic goal.
That's just data from the Department of Administrative Services, John?
Yes, Representative Butler, that's correct. On the mainframe, this is a mainframe application. It's a 1995 version of a statewide accounting system. We implemented that in the 90s, cost us about $21 million with the data mart. Just to give you a sense of scale here, Pennsylvania is currently implementing a web-based application statewide, and the latest estimate I heard on that was well in excess of $300 million. So these newer systems have become very, very expensive, and it's very, very problematic. But this system is a mainframe system, and it's very expensive and difficult to get desktop access to the mainframe. And it's very, very time-consuming and expensive to produce reports, mainframe reports, the old green bar reports. And so to eliminate that cost, we've taken the essential components of the database, and we download that weekly, because the download is there's a cost to download, and so we could download daily, but it's cost prohibitive. And of course, if you download monthly, then you're dealing with up to 4 week old data. So we download weekly. That goes into a data mart, and then everybody is on that internet. So then, with proper controls and protections, then those that are authorized can have access to that data, and they can produce ad hoc reports, meet their management needs. That makes sense?
Mr. Chairman, we have access to it. You really have to understand the accounting records of each agency to get into it, but agencies are using it extremely effectively. This is the one that's the database that the department is accessing through internally for its internal reporting, and it's proven for agencies across state government to be very, very useful, and it's really cheap.
We continue to hear stories that agencies will tell us it would take them in the old days 6 weeks to get a report out of the system. They can do it in 30-40 minutes under the new scenario. So it's been a very successful kind of application.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to, because we didn't touch upon it, and I don't know whether I'm jumping the gun or what, but on your travel card program, how many do we have issued out there?
I do have that as a slated slide.
It is slated, so I'll wait.
Is that all right, Representative Butler? Please. So the next slide is... This is our 0103 slide, and it's essentially exactly the same as our 0305 slide you're going to see in a second. The only difference being that under statewide revenue services, we have five positions there over on the right-hand side, statewide revenue services. All the other positions that I mentioned in my briefing on each of those sections are the same. Shared revenue services had two additional FTE last session, which were anticipated to be needed. They were limited duration, anticipated to be needed in e-commerce, to support e-commerce. But the architecture of the e-commerce changed a little bit, and there were a couple of positions in there that we didn't feel that we could justify, and so we eliminated them. So that the next chart shows that. The next chart is essentially exactly the same for 0305, with the exception of those two positions deleted from the statewide revenue services component. Okay. Any questions on organization charts or anything?
Please.
I can move forward. Under this service delivery slide, I'm on chart 15 here now. We have, that basically goes through again our service delivery in terms of our payroll, accounting and disbursements, e-commerce, accounts receivable, and financial reporting side. Again, I mentioned controls, policies, and procedures. I guess I would mention that a lot of this is driven by state and federal rules. You can imagine the payroll area, for example, requirements for payroll. We have lots of union agreements, that labor negotiated agreements that we have to comply with, that kind of thing. Again, I'll mention training and support to state agencies and financial services to small client agencies. A part of that, controls and policies. Let me bring up our travel cards at this time. We have two credit card programs. The first credit card program is our purchasing card program. Now, many, many businesses, and the ratios I'm reading are in the 80 to 90% of businesses and small businesses are using purchase cards. We call our program the Small Purchase Order Transaction System. We call it SPOTS, Small Purchase Order Transaction System. It's, the purpose is to allow agencies to make high volume, low dollar volume transactions cheaper than processing it through all the paperwork, all the approval processes, all the paperwork, all the system data input. We do that, we consolidate those transactions on a credit card. So the credit card, use of the credit card, helps us to lower, on a statewide basis, transaction costs. Okay? And I think I mentioned last time I was here, I went out to Intel and talked to the controller at Intel, and they said to themselves, you know, who is the best group that are processing the most efficiently credit card or transactions, financial transactions? And their conclusion was it was the banks. The banks know how to process credit card transactions very, very effectively and very efficiently. And so they've moved many of their low
dollar high volume credit card transactions to purchase cards in an effort to save transaction costs. Well, we've done the same. We have about 3,000 spots cards out there in the agencies, about 3,000. The average purchase is about $137. By the way, there are other state studies that have been done and have supported this as well. Total dollars charged on the Visa cards for 2002 amounted to $14,368,000. So we've processed $14,368,000 through the Visa cards for 2002. The spots cards are a liability of the state. So when we give a card to an individual employee and the employee goes out and charges something, that becomes our liability. That is not the liability of the employee. Okay? That's the way the cards work. Now, when the employee charges something, that employee is required to pull the receipts from that charge and attach, when he or she pays the monthly bill, they attach all the receipts to that card, and then the card, one transaction, gets processed through the system. That makes sense? And all the controls are there, and all the documentation and approvals have to be met. All the purchasing rules have to be followed. It's just a payment methodology.
I've had some, Mr. Chair.
Please,
can you tell me how much fraud or things that's occurring in that system? Because I've received some anecdotes, and I'd just like to know with this kind of process.
Well, undoubtedly, to be honest, Chair Butler and Senator Winters, undoubtedly there are going to be instances of fraud. There's going to be instances of fraud and abuse in this thing. We've seen enormous problems at the federal government, particularly in the federal military arena. But at the state level, and I'm going to talk on another slide about the kind of the controls that we have built into the system, where I personally believe that the fraud is minimal in the state, very, very low.
When you say minimum, what do you mean? 1%, 2%?
Oh, I'd say it's probably less than 1%. I'd say it's way less than 1%, particularly on the spots cards.
And can you give us, you don't have to do it now, but what the dollar volume is?
For example, in terms of fraud, Representative Butler, Senator Winters, I don't have a system in place to track that. The fraud is being caught at the agency level when the fiscal office processes the transaction. And they go back to the person who has the card and says, what is this transaction? This is not a state valid state expenditure. We're not paying it. You'll have to.
Is there some way that when that occurs that the agency can report to you what's occurring inside of their agency so that we can have that kind of information?
Representative Butler, Senator Winters, we could give that some thought, some consideration as to what that would be in terms of a total cost of the program. We could probably do something like that because, again, I really think it's pretty minimal.
I guess my concern is that even though we're saying it's pretty minimal, in this kind of budgetary environment, when you're hearing anecdotes out there in the communities that this is taking place, then, you know, as a policymaker, we need to know how to respond to some of these anecdotes. And if there's a way that you can track, if an agency X has had X amount of fraud, then you're able to respond on a statewide usage basis.
Representative Butler, Senator Winters, we will take a look at that and see if we can put in a procedure or design an administratively cost-effective system to be able to capture that information. That's what our goal would be on that.
Because the other question becomes is how do we recapture the dollars and what's the next process within some of the agency? If, in fact, you do have the employee that has committed fraud.
Representative Butler, Senator Winters, if there is an instance of known fraud to occur, the agencies are obligated by law to recover those funds from the employee, and I'm certain that that's happening.
And then there's probably a difference between just out-and-out, inappropriate use, accidental or mindless use of the card versus intentional fraud. So, and unfortunately, probably we hear about one more than the other. But I think that is important. The state is liable for it, and I think the question would be then, what portion of it are we not recovering? Because if there is some abuse of it, we should be recovering everything. But it's also recognized that some of that becomes, in the court system, a portion of the bad debt.
That's true. And there's been some legal activities on some employees that have misused the card.
Representative Johnson?
That feeds right into my question. I'm looking for some reassurance that there is a zero tolerance if it's genuine fraud. The employee would be terminated.
That's Representative Butler and Representative Johnson, that's exactly correct. There's no excuse for that, and we are aggressively pursuing that. We told the agencies to aggressively pursue that.
Good.
Thank you. And we'll get back some information from you, John, if we could, as to the amount of abuse that you're having to sort out and the agencies are sorting out before they get very far, and then what has the disposition of those cases where there have been abuses, if we could.
Representative Butler, that's exactly correct. And I was just going to mention also that Secretary of State looked at this credit card issue, I'm going to say about a year or so ago, and was conducting a risk assessment. And when they looked at our controls and all of the processes and procedures that we have in place and the advice and counsel that we've given the state agencies, they declined not to continue the audit report because they thought things, I believe they thought things were pretty tight.
Senator Winters?
Another question. What's the cost, what's our service rate that the bank assesses us for the use of the Visa card?
Representative Butler and Senator Winters, I'm glad you asked that because there is no cost to use the card. And in fact, they give us a rebate. The rebate that we received, the net rebate that we received for this last period was, I think, around $7,000 that have been returned to the agencies in terms of a rebate for the use of those cards.
Is that competitive among U.S. and other banks, or are we just within U.S.? I'm just looking for the best value
yes,
myself.
Representative Butler and Senator Winters, that's correct. That was a bid out with our partners in our purchasing division, DAS purchasing division, and in fact, the person who helped us is, I think, over the summer going to receive a national award for his efforts to secure one of the lowest cost and best managed cards in the nation.
Great. So we pay no service fees.
That's correct.
And it is a rebate model.
It's a rebate model. We
so
get paid
for 14 million. Well, you might be able to boost that up a little bit. I mean, they're using.
We are watching that very closely. The other card that we have is a different card from the purchase card. It's a travel card. Okay, so we have two card programs. One's a purchase card program, and that liability falls on the state. The next card is a travel card. Now that is given to the employee who travels. That is a personal liability card. Okay, that's a personal liability card. U.S. Bank, for example, when we give an employee a personal liability travel card, U.S. Bank does a formal credit rating check on the employee. Okay? So there's a control right there. We have about 3,000 active cards, a little over 3,000 active cards for travel cards. There's a standard credit limit that goes along with that card of $5,000. Okay, which can be managed by the agency if they want to give a card to somebody and only give them $2,000 credit limit. That's fine. They can do that. They help manage the program. Agencies monitor the use of those travel cards. And, of course, both cards are, I forgot to mention, are monitored at the agency level through an online system so they can review the transactions as they occur. On the travel cards, we also review those. Even though it's personal liability of the employee, we also review any travel card transaction.
I have another question because what does it cost us to monitor?
Well, we have a one of the staff members in our organization spends a limited amount of time going online and reviewing transactions. Fairly easy program to use, and we monitor those transactions that exceed $5,000. And if we have one, if we can't figure out what it is and if it's reasonable, we call them and ask them about that transaction. It's a control that we have built into the system to try to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse from occurring. U.S. Bank is also monitoring these cards. And we've also, in the banking system, have eliminated some organizations from use. So we've turned off certain organizations. They can't walk in and charge something at a particular establishment because that establishment's code has been turned off.
Representative Johnson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to get a flavor for what kind of a purchase a state agent, I mean a state employee would be making in the $5,000 range.
Well, it's cumulative. So they could be out, you know, if they attend a conference on a travel card. Representative Johnson's...
Be one mighty fine conference for $5,000.
But some of the employees have jobs that are routinely involving travel. And they're routinely staying at lodging and incurring maybe a car rental expense, maybe, I don't know, conference costs thrown in there. So it could get up to, you know, a couple thousand dollars before they then in turn submit their expense reimbursement report, which then transfers cash to them to pay off the card.
I know that there are anomalous situations operative in the case of the lottery, but I think the lottery certainly pointed out to a number of Oregonians who are struggling to believe there's credibility in Salem. What guidance does DAS give to traveling employees about appropriate lodging, not staying in five-star hotels? And
we have a Chair Butler and Representative Johnson. We have a separate travel policy, which I can bring to you, which delineates and outlines all of the specific controls and procedures and policies around traveling. Airline costs, for example, they're required to travel coach. On conferences, they're required to analyze within an immediate radius, proximity, close proximity for the conference hotel, whether or not there's cheaper hotels to stay in, and then they're required to stay at the cheaper hotels if the conference hotel rate is higher. We have per diems built into the process that follow federal guidelines, and the federal, I'll tell you the way that works, the federal people contract with a firm out of Wisconsin, Runzenheimer, and they analyze cities all over the United States and internationally, and they produce a per diem amount for lodging. So Portland, for example, has $80. I think that's their per diem. Per diem in Salem, I think, is 50 or 55, maybe it's 52.
New York City might be 500.
Right, could be 125 in New York City or something. But all of those per diems, then, they're required to stay at those hotels at or below the federal per diem. And we reimburse them at their cost. So if they're doing a good job and they're trying to save the state money, they'll stay at a lower cost hotel, and we reimburse them at that cost.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The same service fee, is there a service charge on this particular card as well?
Chair Butler and Senator Winters, no, there's a rebate on this card as well.
How much is the rebate on this?
I believe I gave you the number I gave you was both cards.
It's but both cards?
Both cards.
Both cards combined is
right.
$7,000.
Right.
And the amount of volume of purchases, is that also included in the
$14 million? I think the $14 million I gave you was, I think that was both cards.
So both cards.
Both cards.
Total.
Right. I can verify that. If I'm incorrect, I'll get you the correct information.
Yeah, could you give the amount that's under the travel card and the amount that's under the purchasing, because they're two distinct different activities, and also what the rebate is under both?
Representative Butler, Senator Winters, we'll get that information for
Thank
you.
Thank you. Please proceed, John.
Let's see. And maybe another thing I would tell you is that we've instituted some policies here. The U.S. Bank will cancel the card with 60-day past due balances. So if the employee on their card is not paying, the bank will cancel the card, notify the agency, and then we notify the agency to proceed on collection. And so we're asking the agencies to work with the employees to get those cards paid off. Agencies follow up on employee past due accounts and U.S. Bank.
Are there any in default?
Yes. Representative Butler and Senator Winters, there are some in defaults, and we generally get about maybe three or four a month. We go out to the agency, and we say this card is defaulted, and we need you to collect from that.
Even though it's personal liability.
Even though it's personal liability, we want them to collect and make sure that those employees are paying their cards off.
Follow up. What happens when they don't?
Follow up. Senator, what happens when they don't?
Representative Butler and Senator Winters, if it's a current employee, then we've got a payroll problem with that employee to collect on those cards. We want them to pay those cards off. So management out there are working with those employees to pay those cards off. Yeah, current employees. If it's a past employee, then we go through a collection process.
Even though it's not our liability.
It's not our card. We want them to collect. We want them to pay that card off.
Okay. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm looking for reassurance that a traveling employee's wings get clipped when they're in default, regardless of how valuable an employee they are.
Representative Butler and Representative Johnson, that's exactly correct. We're working with the agency heads. We've got direct contact with the agency heads on these issues, and we're asking them to follow up with those employees to make certain that they're paying these cards off.
Thank you.
We're being very aggressive on these cards.
And there's a total of 6,000 of them outstanding between the state's Visa card and the travel card.
Representative Butler, that's correct.
Okay.
Would you provide us with just percentage or a number of defaults over the past biennium?
Representative Butler, Senator Winters, we can certainly do that.
And the percentage of that you've been able to satisfy that they're no longer in default?
Representative Butler, Senator Winters, will be able to get that information.
Thank you.
The only question that leaves me with, John, is that on the travel card, and I appreciate what we're trying to do to make certain that the state's credit, once we send these cards out to our employees for traveling purposes, state's credit is maintained, but the concern that I have is that if you have an employee who has been reimbursed by the state and has refused to pay that, I'm wondering, the reimbursement check, I'm going to guess, just goes straight out to the employee. Shouldn't that reimbursement check put the employee's name / travel card on it so that that reimbursement stays with the travel card so that they're not cashing this and tennis shoeing on us?
Representative Butler and members of the committee, that's an option that we're giving some serious consideration to. Being able to flag that payment, if we have a cardholder out there that has got a problem making these payments. First of all, if they're delinquent, 6 days, the card's going to be canceled. So they won't have a card anymore.
I appreciate that, but my concern is that if they start receiving a check back for $600 or $800 a month from the state and they're paying $15, the minimum amount under the card arrangement for the couple of months that they've got, the state has really not protected the credit card issuer in that regard. Would you just let us know how difficult it would be to make sure that the travel card company's name was issued on that particular group of cards so that in addition to the traveler who had that card, also the travel card company's name shows up on the payee line of that check? Because, it is, after all, an obligation of the state to help travel if they are turning in their reimbursement vouchers. But if we're going to, rather than run these things back through a process that says, yes, we don't have personal liability, or we don't have a liability as a state, they have a personal liability, but we're going to help the travel card company collect on them, then we sure ought to go ahead and limit our collection costs and the overhead by issuing the reimbursements to the individual, the employee and the travel card company, I would think. That would seem reasonable.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Winters.
On the travel card, let's say that for budgetary reasons that this panel and other panels actually takes the policy that we're really curtailing out-state travel and other travels. And you have this individual out there with the travel card who can travel. Do they have to have prior approval from their agency before they can utilize that card? Do they go ahead and utilize the card and then ask for reimbursement? I'm looking at, then what happens? Do we then reimburse them?
Representative Butler, that's exactly the way the system works. If you have an employee that has an occasional need to travel or a regular need to travel, you might authorize that employee to have a U.S. Bank travel card. It works very similar in the private sector. That doesn't give you any rights to go out and use that card for travel at will. You still have to comply with the state travel policies. and with the travel controls that have been built into your agency. So if an employee is going to go on a trip, they have to get permission from their supervisor, just like they normally would. They can go out, and they have to comply with all the other policies, use of the state vehicle, you know, coach class travel, per diem limits are all in place, and any other kind of rules or regulations, they still have to follow all of that. The only thing that this allows them to do is to pay for hotel, maybe some parking, maybe if they're out of state and they're using a vehicle, or a car rental agency, they can pay for that. Once they do, then they turn that in, all of those receipts and all of that information in for reimbursement. It gets all reviewed again then by the supervisor. It goes through the accounting system. A payment is issued to the employee, and what Representative Butler is suggesting is maybe we include the name of the bank on that. It goes to the employee, and then the employee pays the card because it's a personal credit card. The liability stays with the employee.
But they don't put a lot of other charges on it, or if they wanted to buy some toys at Costco, they could do that, but...
They could do that, and we ask them not to do that. We have policies in place
that
prohibit them.
So that's a policy
That's a policy. It's only for state travel regulations only.
Follow-up.
I'm Jackie Winters. If we have a state freeze on out-state travel, and I have a travel card, and even though we have a freeze, I can use my card, can't I? I can use my card, charge and stuff, and you may not say it's not reimbursable, but I have utilized that card.
Representative Butler, Senator Winters, that's exactly correct.
So then if I'm just...
You violated policy.
I violated policy. And if I do it continuously, what happens?
Then the card will be revoked.
And I assume that there would probably be some oversight by the agencies.
There is oversight by the agencies. We have a group of travel coordinators out in each of the agency. That's part of their job. We have annual training. We have policies. We have a policy that the employee reads, and I hereby agree to submit to these policies or whatever. They sign off on that. There's a number of factors and controls at play here on the program, and to provide a reasonable level of control on this.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may be too specific a question, actually. I'm just trying to clarify something. Employee being paid for the use of the travel card and then turning that payment over to the bank for payment on the card. In that payment, are sometimes things paid for in terms of, I'm just trying to figure out how problematic this might be. Are other things that included where the employee did not charge it on the card, where they are trying to actually simply being reimbursed for other expenses that they paid for, like with their personal credit cards, or they paid for, and I'm not saying we shouldn't split the transaction and give them one check that goes to the bank and one check to go to that, but would we be splitting the transaction from current practice?
Representative Butler and Senator Devlin, if I understand your question correct, here's what happens. If I travel and I come back to the state from an out-of-state trip, and I've got some lodging on there, maybe a car rental, something like this, I've charged it to the state travel card. That bill is being processed, and pretty soon I'm going to get a bill from the bank or an invoice from the bank. Meanwhile, I've completed an expense reimbursement form, and I've stated the dates I've traveled, and I've put on here what the travel lodging costs are, what the transportation costs are. I've detailed all that out. I've attached all my receipts to it. I submit that to my state fiscal office for processing. The fiscal officer then reviews that. Did the employee have authorization to travel? Yes. Was the employee in compliance with all the policies and procedures? Yes. Then they approve it. It goes through the accounting system. The check is cut or a payment is made to the employee. Now, the employee probably signs that and puts that right into his or her bank. A couple of days later, the bank statement shows up from U.S. Bank. They write a check and pay the bank.
But Mr. Chairman, but along those same lines, and I'm getting too technical here, but along those same lines, there may be things on that expense record where the employee didn't use the card, where they're eligible for reimbursement, they're following the guidelines, they simply did not use the card. So they may be paid more than actually what the debt is on the card, and the employee is actually is paying off the card, but they're still receiving something in addition. So you would be if you make the check payable to the bank,
Then you're having to do two separate transactions.
We'd have to figure out how to split that.
Which may not be a bad thing either, to do two separate, but it would be an additional transaction.
But that's an excellent point, Senator Bevel, and that's because if you have an employee that's eaten most of their meals at restaurants that would take the their state's travel cards, but some of their meals at McDonald's where they didn't use it, at that particular point you'd have a split reimbursement. You might have $3.80 to the employee and $380 to the state's credit card. So that's an excellent point. That may create more nightmare. The important thing is to have good employees that are going to pay off their debt. And maybe in that regard, when you see any kinds of aging on a credit card at that particular point, it would trigger some piece of machinery that says, hey, wait a minute, all reimbursements need to be now moved directly to the travel card so that even if there is a $380 with $30 of that out of the employee's pocket, the check is written to the travel company until such time as that old debt is taken care of. I don't know. Maybe just a split debt arrangement is the best way to take care of that.
One of the things,
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, that I would like to see is if I know there's a convenience factor in here, and we're saying we're getting a $7,000 rebate, but conversely, I'd like to know if whether it's costing us money or saving us money. Given in consideration $7,000, and we're talking time and the whole process of getting this through, to me, I'm looking at convenience versus and also
we're not making any money on it, Senator. I can assure you that
$7,000 isn't making us a lot. But I've
Representative and Senator Winters, the alternative to using a credit card is called a cash advance, and the problems that you have in a cash advance are even more so than the credit card.
Please.
So we would issue a cash advance to an employee, then you've got the problem of multiple cash advances to account for, and then sometimes the employee comes back and pays off some of that cash advance, and then we've got to track that. It becomes an administrative challenge.
I like the credit card idea, and I want to respect exactly what Senator Devlin has said, and that is maybe more difficult to start splitting that transaction out. Just hire really, really good employees and make sure that all the agencies are monitoring their really, really good employees, and we won't have any difficulty there. Continue, please, Controller Ackerman.
Okay, on the next slide, we're going to address some performance measures here. It's on slide 16. And we generally have, or in the accounting division, or in the state controller's division, we have 60 performance measures. And I meet, these are tracked at each section level, and I meet quarterly with our management staff to go over 60 performance measures. Some are annual, some are monthly, you know, some are quarterly. But we have about 60 performance measures. The three measures here that you see are probably the kind of the highest aggregate measures that pertain to the entire division. The first one is a percentage of state agencies earning SCD Gold Star certification. We have about a 90% achievement rate here. These are the agencies that comply fully with all of our requirements in terms of financial reporting. And this is an annual kind of a thing. It's
I'm not familiar with the term SCD, John.
State Controllers Division.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
The State Controllers Division issues these Gold Star certification, and we keep track of how well the agencies comply with our rules and procedures for development of our annual financial statement. There's a lot of disclosures and data and information that agencies have that are required to come in, meet certain deadlines and certain quality standards. And that's also a reflection on our agencies. It's also a reflection on our ability to train them and to communicate to them the proper policies and procedures.
They're giving out more gold stars now than you were last year.
I think it's down a little bit this year, Representative Butler, and that's probably because this is a biennium cutover and we had a lot of people spending a lot of time in budget development.
Okay.
But it's not much. It's not a big decrease.
Okay.
It's roughly around, in 2000 it was 97%, in 2005 is our target, is 98%, and I think this past year it was like 93%, something like this. So it wasn't that big of a fall off. Our second goal there, of course, in addition to earning a clean opinion from the state auditors, that clean opinion is important for our financial statements to make sure that we are fully in compliance with the rules and regulations from the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. We also subscribe to the GFOA. GFOA stands for Government Finance Officers Association. It's out of Chicago. They have a very stringent standards, set of standards for complying with to get that certificate. They have many participants here. You can imagine 3,000 counties, 50 states, 50,000 cities, 14,000 school districts. Many of those entities submit their financial statements for compliance. Oregon has followed that standard. We submit that to Chicago. Chicago sends it out to three states, large cities, large counties. They review our financial statements for standards, and then they send back comments to us on ways we can improve and be even in more compliance. And so we've earned that standard for a number of years. And lastly is a percent of respondents to department-wide performance satisfaction survey. We did this survey about 2 years ago, and we got 80%. Good rated us good to excellent. We sent this out to all of our customers and stakeholders. We get it back, we aggregate the data, and our rating was around, was 80% the last time we went out, good to excellent. And our standard there is probably going to be around 90%. Keep in mind, we're somewhat of a regulatory agency, and so we always, we're not going to get a perfect score, I can guarantee you.
You don't think that they're going to score you any higher than they score the IRS or the Department of Revenue or something like that?
Something very close to that. Factors affecting our services, and of course, being in technology and having to apply rules and regulations, we're very sensitive to changes in technology, very sensitive to changes in new rules and regulations, being whether they're promulgated out of the state or out of the federal government or out of the National Accounting Standards Boards. Economies of scale is a driver for us. We focus on what is best to centralize and where can we achieve those economies of scale. So if we're looking at, for example, the system change, we look at, is this system change worth the money on a statewide scale? Are we going to aggregate enough benefits statewide for us to make an investment? And so we strive for economies of scale here in our systems investment, that portion of our budget that goes into systems. Of course, coordination and communication is of paramount importance to us. We value our customers. Our state agencies are our customers. We have many stakeholders, state auditors, budget office, purchasing people, state treasury. We make sure that we do a good job of coordinating and communications with those folks. And the last one, trickle-down effect of agency-constrained resources. In the early 80s, when we had a recession, it took probably the state fiscal community 10 years to get out of that because we had a lot of problems with cutbacks in agencies. Accountants, you know, it's really tough to compete with program when you're in a, when you're an accountant or a fiscal officer in an agency. The program becomes paramount. There's a lot of pressure to deliver program services, and the tendency, and I think Senator Devlin mentioned this, the tendency is to cut administration. And we feel that because there's a sense of synergy between the central office and the agencies. When they're not doing their job because they have short resources or they've shortened their quality, it affects us. We've got to start trying to figure out how we're going to make up for that. The other thing is a lack of effective of internal audit in the state. Again, I'm glad that Gary mentioned internal auditors because this is something that we've subscribed to for many, many years, trying to strengthen internal auditing in the agencies. They're the primary folks out there that are key to the governance structure that help us implement controls in the agencies. I mentioned the we'd like to get more into compliance. We don't have compliance resources in our division to be out in the field in an outreach capacity to help the agencies better define their internal control structures and document them and follow proper policies and procedures. Part of the group that we rely on is our external auditors, but the external auditors, the Secretary of State's office, is somewhat limited on their resources out in the field to address these issues. A group that we do rely on out there is the agency's internal auditors to help identify risks and to apply appropriate corrective action where they see problems, particularly with respect to noncompliance with our policies and procedures in the agencies. So we feel very strongly that we need to have that internal audit presence in the agency. Let me just, for example, if I could, just read you one clip from an audit that we just got last week from the Secretary of State. And this maybe will give you an idea of what I'm talking about here. It says, our audit found that the department has, and this is a department I don't know, I just picked it out and copied it here, has significant weaknesses in its system of internal controls.
Specifically, the department's documented policies and procedures governing financial activities and system development are either out of date or non-existent. The department is not following established contracting guidelines, state policy for cash receipting. The department has not established a risk assessment process. The department has elected not to fill its internal audit position. Assignments of duties at the district or program level are not fully established, described, and delegated. Some accounting staff may not be adequately trained to perform their assigned duties, and position descriptions are out of date. So now, this is a finding in an agency, and what staff do I have to go out in an outreach capacity and work with that agency to resolve some of this? It's very difficult, and this relates to that position I told you I put on hold, this internal control position that we need to get out into the field, we need to get out into the agencies and starting to address some of these issues. This has a direct bearing on the quality and effectiveness of our ability to deliver a financial statement that meets standards.
But, John, at the same time, I'm wondering how much of that is your responsibility. I mean, Senator Ferrioli just stopped for just a moment and told me all of the problems that I've got in one of the towns that we serve together as elected officials as a result of the budget cuts. I mean, I have one vote in the legislature. I have one vote as a citizen with regard to Measure 28, and now I'm going to be skewered as a result of closure of a facility. And so I guess you're the state controller, and you've got an agency who hires an accountant which isn't getting the job done, folks that haven't been properly trained. And I'm looking at that and I'm saying, how much of that is going to translate down to your responsibility? I appreciate the fact that as the state controller, you have a responsibility to recognize. But as an accountant, we only can reach out and touch someone with a certain sized pole and stick. And we don't really have much authority to go beyond that. And I have a concern as to how much of that is truly your responsibility when they don't hire correctly.
Representative Butler and members of the committee that are left.
it was a subcommittee of a subcommittee to start off with. That's where we'll end up, John, anyway.
That is a terrific observation, because we're saying DAS needs to be more of a management tool. And if DAS is going to be more of a management tool, then we need to be able to go out into the agencies and work with these agencies to help solve some of these problems. We rely on the Secretary of State's office for some of this information and for some of this lever, if you will, to affect change. We rely on the internal auditors in the state, and that's how important that is to me, because this is part of our governance structure. And when we start eliminating internal auditors, we're going to jack up the risk quotient, we're going to start having more of these problems, and this is going to come back to haunt us in years downstream.
Well, I don't want to have happen what happened back in 1980, again, you know, showing up 10 years later from the 2002 recession. I guess my concern here is that if an agency hires deficiently and trains deficiently and those kinds of things, I certainly believe the state comptroller's office is the place to go ahead and say the buck stops here. But then the fee for service needs to be based upon not a uniform assessment to everyone, but by golly, that department who has chosen to hire unwisely, those are the folks that need the assessment. It's a fee for service at that point. I don't know, Senator Devlin, do you have a feel for that? I feel like that for one agency to pick up the freight for another agency who wants to be lazy or say, hey, we're going to do something inefficiently, that's kind of a difficult situation. Is it a fee-for-service presently?
Representative Butler, members of the committee, this right now is an assessment-driven position.
It's all over the state.
It's all, you know, it's dealing with agencies, you know, on a statewide basis.
We've exhausted our time, but I'm gonna keep this open for a few minutes to allow you to continue on with your schedule. And now we have your boss here, and I watched his forehead turn red. So go ahead,
Mr. Chairman and Senator Devlin. I just want to offer one observation, which I think is consistent with what you're saying. When there's the kind of audit problem that John has referred to, It's the agency director that's responsible for addressing that audit problem, and it's my job to hold that agency director accountable for taking care of that problem. We get every audit report that's done in the state comes to my office, comes to John's office. we know where the audit exceptions are, and we know exactly what they are. And this is all part of what I was describing yesterday as accountability, performance accountability for the agency heads. And I think you're right. John is not going to be able to address every one of these problems, and he won't be and shouldn't be the one held accountable for them. But the agency head, he or she is accountable for addressing those problems, whether they've hired poorly or trained poorly or managed poorly. Whatever the reason is, their job is to address that problem, and that's what I'm going to hold them accountable for, Mr. Chairman. So that's the line of how you correct this performance, I think. And to the extent that you know, I'm saying to an agency head, you have a bad audit here, you need to either get the right people in there, get them trained. We'll be glad to give you advice. John will be there to give you advice and so on like that. But agency head, you got to fix this problem. Otherwise, the problem just gets transferred to John or it gets transferred to me, and that's not acceptable. So.
Thank you very much, Director Weeks. Senator, I think the Senate meets at 11 o'clock, is that correct?
Yes.
And we do have a fire to put out back in our district. Senator Ferrioli is fending off the folks right now.
You need some assistance, Mr. Chairman.
I think I'm certainly willing to take the time. Unfortunately, we're gonna run out of time. So I wonder if we could pick this one up back the State Comptroller's budget tomorrow and finish that up, get through the Human Resources Division, and then we're only about 50% behind. Dallas, give me some counsel, please.
We're not scheduled for tomorrow, sir.
That's right. We're not scheduled for tomorrow. So if you want to come in and do it tomorrow, you're welcome to do that. We can get through it in a hurry. There won't be any questions.
We'll be here, Mr. Chairman.
On Monday.
Monday, we'll see you then. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
We'll close until Monday then. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Dylan.